Welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is evaluating the health of your IBM HTTP server. Today's presenters are Marvin Knight and Jim Eberwein. Marvin has been with the IBM Corporation for 30 years. He is currently an advisory software engineer supporting the IBM HTTP server, HTTP plugin, and Edge components. Prior to that, he worked in ISPF development and support. Jim Eberwein is a senior software engineer in IBM Software Group, RTP, North Carolina. He joined IBM in September 1986 and has performed numerous roles at IBM, primarily providing technical support for various IBM software products. Jim currently supports the IBM HTTP server and IBM WebSphere plugin products. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Jim. Jim, you may begin.
Thanks, David. And I'll ask you to please turn to page 2 of the presentation. Okay, the agenda. Okay, welcome to Evaluating the Health of Your IBM HTTP Server presentation. Throughout this presentation, references to the IBM HTTP Server for WebSphere Application Server may also include the IBM HTTP Server or simply IHS. Our goal today is to introduce the web server administrator with various practices and procedures which will enable them to monitor the current status of the IHS web server. Our focus will begin with a brief overview of the IBM HTTP Server product, and then we're going to turn our attention to understanding the topology of the system, as the web server is just one point in the network. We will then look at subcomponents of the web server, which are typically referenced when investigating the current status of the web server. Moving on to slide 3, why do we do a health check? Okay. Well, when your application is first placed into production, we're going to assume that the end-user community has provided feedback and criteria on their expectations for the overall performance of the system, as well as the time the system has to be available for their use, and the number of users that can access the system at the same time. Okay. Once this criteria has been met, then the end-users, if they do encounter problems, they're going to look at the web server administrator to rectify the issue. So we want to be a proactive web administrator, and by doing that, we're going to list the help of existing tools and follow certain procedures to ensure that these requirements are met throughout the life of the application system before we wait for the end users to escalate. Examples of tools that the admin might use would be NetStat, Telnet, Ping, NSLookup. Now, we're not going to go into the details of those tools. Okay. Instead, what we're going to focus on are the problem diagnostics and procedures, error logs, that IHS provides. But before we go into that information, let's take a quick introduction of the IHS web server. Page 4. Okay. Understanding IHS. IBM HTTP Server is included with the WebSphere Application Server. It is based on either Apache 2.0 or 2.2, depending upon the version release of IHS, and it provides a rich set of Apache features in addition to IBM enhancements. If you're familiar with Apache, then it should not take you much time to understand the features of IHS. IBM also packages a free downloadable version of IHS. However, support for that package must be purchased separately. The version that comes with WAS, or WebSphere Application Server, has some caveats on what is supported, as not all features provided with Apache are supported. You can refer to the Information Center for a complete list of Apache libraries, modules, and directives supported by IHS. One of the common questions we get is, are CGI scripts supported? And no, they are not. That's not within the support provided by IBM. To determine the version of Apache web server associated with the version of IHS that you have installed, you can either run the Apache ECTL command or the Apache command, depending on your OS, and add the -v parameter, and that will provide that information. Administrators of IHS, primarily performed by the administration of IHS is primarily performed by configuration of the httpd.conf file. As the WebSphere plugin plays a pivotal role in the distribution of HTTP requests, the web server admin should also be familiar with the contents of this file, although it's typically going to be maintained within the WebSphere admin console. Error logging and product tracing are typically the first areas a web administrator will investigate when they are inspecting the system. For issues with IHS, the access logs, the error logs, and the plugin logs are the primary files to investigate. Moving on to slide 5, network topology. All right, so when we look at the topology, you have to say, okay, what's in front of the web server? Okay, what we have here is demonstrated is a web server that incorporates the plugin and is fronting a WAS application server. There's a firewall that may be in between the two. Okay, what's not shown are other network devices, for example, a load balancer that's going to proxy the client request to the web server. It's very important to understand what is in front of the web server to fully recognize that their configuration can cause issues on these back-end servers. For example, a load balancer or firewall could be timing out connections before the application server is able to complete the request. This could result in HTTP 500 errors seen in the web server logs and reported by the end users. It is recommended that the web server administrators map out their topology and then identify the hosts, IP addresses of each server in the environment. Slide number 6. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about fixed packs. Okay, a common convention for application systems is that if the end users are not experiencing problems, then there's no need to apply maintenance. After all, there's a cost to having to maintain a test system, which the maintenance would first have to be installed on, and then you have to do your testing, you have to make sure that there's no unexpected behaviors or no errors introduced with this maintenance. However, we do stress it's a good idea for the IHS admins to monitor the product defects identified as APARs that are corrected with each service update. Since the WebServe plugin is an integral part of the IHS topology, the administrator should be aware of APARs for the plugin as well as those corrected in IHS. The bottom portion of this slide has a link to the WebServe fix packs. It's considered a best practice to use the IBM notifications tool to monitor updates to this website. These lists should then be reviewed by the development team to see if any of the reported problems that have been corrected by the fix packs could impact their applications. To determine the current fix pack level for your IHS installation, you can either check the error log file or, like I mentioned earlier, include the -v parameter on the Apache startup commands. The plugin log is also going to contain its current fixback level. It's important to understand that the current plugin policy states that the plugin should be at the current level or higher than the WAS JVM. Thus, to find the fixback level of the JVM, you just look in its system out or trace files. Moving on to slide number 7. Okay, applying the fixbacks. Okay, depending on the version of WebServe you have installed, you're either going to use the IBM Installation Manager or the WebServe Update Installer to apply fixpacks. Update Installer was used prior to version 8. With version 8, the WebServe product set now uses the IBM Installation Manager that you may have used with other IBM products. Okay. During the time you install fixpacks, you may want to temporarily redirect users to site down for maintenance page. The link that we have at the bottom of this page provides you the steps to do that task. Slides 8 through 18, we're going to go through relatively fast. This shows you the version 7 update installer that you would be using, and this is just the welcome screen. Slide number 9 allows you to go ahead and pick the directory. Then you go to slide 10, and that's where you're selecting where the location of your fixpack is. Slide number 11 is the source selection, and then slide number 12 indicates update completion. And what I've done is I've included these slides just for your reference. If you're going to go through the process, you can map what you're seeing on your monitor to what you see here in the presentation. With slide number 13, we go into the installation manager. Here you click update. That takes you to slide number 14. You end up selecting the product, and then you move on to 15. 16 allows you to confirm your selection, 17 will give you a summary, and 18 should show you that you've completed your task. Moving on to slide number 19, software vulnerabilities. Okay, and this is where we're talking about you really need to look at your fix packs to see what vulnerabilities IBM has identified and corrected. Okay, IHS, I mentioned earlier, is based on Apache. There are known software vulnerabilities that do exist in native Apache that might trigger security warnings in some vulnerability scanning programs when you run them against your IHS install. Some of these scanners will only look at the server version string when assessing vulnerabilities, and they might not be aware of different version or fixed levels of IHS. Also, many of these Apache vulnerabilities don't even apply to IHS for several different reasons based on the vulnerability. Some of these reasons are IHS provides an alternate implementation of the Apache feature which contained the vulnerability. For example, our SSL security, we do it different. IHS does not provide the Apache feature which contained the vulnerability. Okay, could be on a different module. IHS is based on a level of Apache which did not have the vulnerability. Remember, we're just based on 2.0 and 2.2. So if it's a vulnerability on 2.4, that wouldn't affect us. And it's possible that the fix pack for IHS that you have installed already contains the fix for that vulnerability. To see the vulnerability is included in IHS, once again, you can use the -v, and that's an uppercase V command, and that will give you the complete list of vulnerabilities that have been corrected. If IBM does determine a vulnerability does apply, then we're either going to take an APAR or we're going to document a security flash and release that, which will provide details on resolving the problem. You can find more details on some known vulnerabilities by searching the list of APARs included in the fix pack. Moving on to slide 20, inspecting logs. The logs provided with IHS and the plugin are the key files the web server admin can review to see what the current state the web server is in. For IHS, the messages are written to the error log file. For plugin, it's the plugin log. The default logging levels for both IHS and plugin may not give enough information to determine the real root cause of the problem that the web server is encountering. The default setting for IHS is warning messages, and the plugin is error messages. Interpreting these messages can be difficult, so it's best to review the provided links to give an explanation of the messages you see in these log files. If additional information is needed from these log files, it's recommended to change the logging levels to debug for IHS and trace for the plugin. In addition to the error log, IHS also provides an access log, which can be used to check the status of specific HTTP requests that are being handled by the web server. This is the file that I personally browse when checking the status of the web server. Moving on to page 21. All right, let's talk about the access log. The information written in the access log is configurable. It's via attributes specified in the log format directive defined within the http.conf file. Okay, that config file, I usually let it go to the default common setting, and the information that I pull would be like the failing URI, the time of the error, the HTTP response code. The location of the access log is configurable as well. There's a custom log directive. That's going to provide the links that I provide there will allow you to find out more information about these directives. Since the web server usually sees a lot of activity, it's strongly recommended that the web server set up a log rotation so that it's easier to manage the file. Also, directives are valid in both the global section of the config file or specific virtual host stanzas, so it's possible to log requests to separate access logs. Okay. Typically, it's routed in the one in the global section, but if you wanted to do your for different virtual hosts, you could do that. Moving on to slide 22, status codes. So if you look at RFC 2616, essentially that says that each HTTP request received by a server must be followed by a server response message. And part of that message would contain a numeric status code. This status code is a three-digit number, integer, that the server provides as a response to how it handled the request. A web server admin should be familiar with these codes and understand which ones are expected for each HTTP request and which ones are indication of a problem. In my experience, when I'm looking at the access log, I'm looking for anything that's not a 200, typically a 500 or 404s or 400. If you want to have more information about these status codes, we actually have a different WebSphere Technical Exchange presentation, and I've provided a link to that. So you can just follow that link and listen to that on previous recording session. Moving on to slide 23. Here's an example in entering the access log. Okay. This was generated using the common log format directive. Not all parameters are going to have a value in written and trace. In those cases, you would see a dash. As I mentioned earlier, what I'm interested in is the UI request and the HTTP response codes. Those are represented by %R and %S parameters specified on the log format directive. A complete list of log format parameters can be found at the Apache website, and I provided a link for you there. Moving on to slide 24. Okay, this is the error log file. You want to check the logs to determine if the web server is experiencing a problem. You can find the error logs in the directory specified the error log directive in your config file. So the size of the error log typically does not grow as fast as the access log. It's also possible to rotate this using the same technique as the access log. The log level directive allows the admin to control the number of messages logged to the error log. Similar to the access log, the web server configuration can control the logging information to either a common error log or a virtual host definition to have its own. The recommendation for us is to say, go ahead and use a common log file. Moving on to slide 25, the plugin log. The plugin log, that's used to document the communication between the IHS web server and the back-end WAS application server. Previously mentioned, the default log level is set to error. The actual location of the log is declared in the plugin configuration XML file. You can review that file for the log element to see where the plugin log is stored and what the trace setting is defined as. If you need assistance understanding any error messages found in this file, you can access the link provided. And there's also a previously defined WESTI presentation that discusses the file in detail. Just search on the keywords plugin technical overview in the previously recorded sessions to access that presentation. And moving on to slide 26, when you manage log files, there are some best practices. Plugin log, that if you do have it set to trace level, it's going to grow really large really fast, and you want to monitor that. Don't let it get up to 2 gigabytes. It's very hard on some servers that can prevent the web server from starting if the file gets too big. Editors don't really respond well when you're working with large files. So the recommended approach is to do log rotation. Mentioned earlier that you can do that with the error log and the access log, and there's a link there that tells how to do that. You want to ensure that you've got detailed tracing turned off when you don't need it so you're not affecting performance. And the log format is the directive that will control all that. At this point in the presentation, I'm going to turn over control to my colleague, Marv Knight, and I'll let you move on to slide number 27.
Thanks, Jim. On this slide, we're looking at certificates. One of the most important things when dealing with SSL is the certificate that's used by the web server. These certificates have a set life, so they will expire. When the certificate expires, you will lose SSL communication. So it's important to keep track of when your certificate expires so that you can renew it ahead of time. IHS does not provide a utility that monitors your certificate expiration date. This is why it's important that you maintain this yourself. Keep track of when the certificate expires. I would suggest that when you get new certificates, you note somewhere where that expiration is going to happen so that you can set up in advance something to allow you to then renew it ahead of time. We use iKeyman primarily for renewing certificates. We could probably go into another 30, 40 minutes just talking about iKeyman. The purpose of this is not to go into an iKeyman discussion, but just provide you some of the details. If you want more information regarding renewing certificates or some of the functions of IQMAN. If we have time at the end of the presentation, we can certainly entertain some questions on that. Basically, with the IQMAN for the renewal of a certificate, there's two ways of doing it. One is an actual renewal, and in that case, from the personal certificate pull-down section, you go to personal certificates, then there will be a button for recreate certificate request. That is what you use for renewing a certificate. In some cases, such as changing a key from 1024 to 2048, you have to create a brand new certificate for your web server. In that case, you would create a brand new certificate request, which requires you going to your personal certificate request pull down from IQMAN and then doing the create request. Another piece to be aware of that's not really part of IHS but is a piece of it, so to speak, is the WebSphere plugin. The plugin also has a separate KDB, and within that you would have a certificate. The personal certificate for the plugin is not typically used, but if it does expire, it can keep your web server or the plugin from starting. That would basically keep any communication to the application server from happening. So you need to be aware of the plugin certificate as well. Additionally, the plugin KDB contains signer certificates for your application server. If you renew or change application server certificates, the plugin needs to be aware of these changes with the signer certificates. Slide 28, please. This shows you a certificate as we view it in IQMAN. Basically, this is just going to show you some of the fields that are available, give you information. The primary piece that you might want to pull away from here is the issued to and issued by fields, which give you the certificate name of who the certificate is for, and then who actually issued the certificate. In the case of certificate authorities, your issued by is usually going to be a certificate authority or an intermediate certificate. This is what we use to follow a chain for when you have chaining errors with certificates. So this is important information and can be used for following when you have chain problems with your certificates. Slide 29, please. The KDB expiration. Within the IQMAN utility, we give you the ability to see the expiration, and you set it when you create a your KDB. You can also set an expiration date from one of the pull-downs, and this is just showing you the screens to change the certificate expiration. Next screen, slide 30. There's also a command interface to the key store or the KDB file. This is the GSK7 CAPI command. In version 8, the 7 is dropped and it's just called GSK CAPI command. Version 8 is using version 8 of GSKIT and they just dropped the number from the command name. Oftentimes you'll want to use the CAPI command interface rather than IQMAN because you may not have access to a GUI. Also, the CAPI command does not use Java, so this gives you an interface that's not Java-based for those sites that have restrictions on using Java on some of their servers. So this is a good command to be aware of. Here we're showing you the actual command for showing the expiration date, and then a second command that shows you the details on the certificate itself. Screen 31, please. Concurrent processing. Oftentimes, the default values that are supplied with the HTTP.com file, your MPM settings, may not handle the type load you're expecting. In that particular case, you're going to need to do some tuning. What we've provided here is a link to the IHS DIAG performance guide. This section in IHS DIAG has many pieces within it that give you information about how to do your tuning with your MPM settings, whether it be your max clients, the start servers. It's basically a guide that allows you to know what the fields are and then how to do the tuning and what settings to try. We in support do not do tuning, nor are we responsible for tuning. That's typically something done by IBM services. However, this guide will give you some basics for how to start and then do the experimentation on your test system when you're trying to set up your actual workload and running something like Load Runner to simulate load. You can then use this section to try and set the best values for the MPM settings themselves. Slide 32, please. One of the pieces you'll have that's discussed in the performance guide is the server status page, which is using mod status. This is actually a web interface that will give you information about the state of the web server, your threads that are active, the CPU usage, memory. It's good information in terms of looking at the health of the web server itself. The supplied HTTP conf file actually has the directives for running this, and you can typically limit the access based off of either an IP address, a domain name, so that only select people are allowed to look at this web page. Once again, the documentation in IHS DIAG goes into much more discussion on this. So keep in mind IHS DIAG. We'll discuss that in a little bit more detail further. Page 33, please. MPM stats. This is an alternative to using the web interface or the status page. MPM stats will let you write to the error log and give you statistical information within the error log itself. You also have the ability to set up how often you do the monitoring and writing to the error log. The information on this is also included in IHS DIAG and tells you in detail how to code this to utilize. And the error log is where you would look at the information. Page 34, please. Response time. This goes back to utilizing the access log. Oftentimes, we get requests coming in to PMRs where they're asking, there's a problem in performance with IHS. Well, what we don't really know is whether the problem is in the web server, the plugin, the application server. There's two values you can specify for the log format, which would then put it in the access log, percent uppercase T and percent uppercase D. Percent uppercase D is probably what we utilize most or request you to utilize, which will give you the time in milliseconds. Percent T will give you the time in seconds. But if you're trying to determine how long requests take, this is a quick way of logging it in the access log to know and isolate which particular request may be eating up time. So you might put this into your log format, then look at your access log and find out that certain post requests or certain GET requests tend to take 10 seconds or take 20 seconds. Using the percent D is the technique we prefer because it allows you to then set up a fine string using either something like Notepad where you can use a regular expression to look for seven digits in a row, which will then isolate requests that take more than 1 second. Or if you do it for eight digits, now you're talking 20, 30, 40 seconds. The tech note that's shown in the slide is the tech note that actually shows how to set up the percent T or percent D for doing these measurements in the access log. Page 35, please. Load balancing. This is another area that we frequently see come into us where someone questions whether the plugin is actually performing load balancing correctly. Oftentimes, the load balancing is going to be skewed because of your JSession ID, because the plugin is going to keep you to a server based off of session information. Also, if a plugin marks a server down, that server goes out of the particular request string in terms of what servers are available, so that can skew some of your numbers. The plugin log is going to show you whether we have servers marked down, whether you see certain information such as if you're running at log level stats, then you'll get information in the plugin log that would actually give you statistical information for your load balancing. It'll tell you whether we're doing the balancing based off of JSession ID, or not JSession ID, just session ID, which is affinity, or non-affinity request. The stats level of your plugin log is set by setting log level equals stats in your plugin CFG XML file. This will give you the load balancing information, but as in the trace information, it can get verbose, so you need to monitor that carefully as to whether your plugin log is growing to the point where you might come close to exceeding 2 gig or not. So use it sparingly and only when you're just worried about whether balancing's working correctly. It can give you good information. 36, please. This is just going into the log level stats and how to set it. And it's showing you one of the results for a log level stats information so that it shows you your affinity requests and total requests. Typically, we would subtract the affinity request from the total request to get something like 16 in this particular case. Compare that to all the other servers that are in your cluster, and if you see that your total request less the affinity request is pretty much equal across the board, then you know that the plugin is sending the request to the app servers in a fairly load-balanced way. Screen 37, please. IHS DIAG. This is probably the first place most of our Level 2s will go to when you come in with a problem. So it's a good link to have in your favorites. We've supplied the link at the bottom of the screen here. We use this for collecting data for your must-gather for hangs, crashes, high CPU, startup failures. What we do with these must-gather is the actual IHS DIAG utility has an interface to your system tools, whether it's GDB, DBX, whatever. It's providing a way for you to run a script that will then gather the information such as the crash information or doing 3 Java cores to check whether something's hung or not. It's an interface that we use for almost every problem that comes in. Now, because of what the tool does, we like to make sure that this system is kept current. And periodically, development will put out a new level of the IHS DIAG. So we may ask you when you come in to install the latest IHS DIAG. And the reason for this is the utility will actually do things such as on a crash, when it looks at your backtrace, it will look for known problems and actually give you an APAR number associated with the crash. That information is recorded in the report file that's produced by the script that runs. So the bottom line on that, go to the IHS DIAG link, look at the documentation that's out there. There's quite a bit of useful information in terms of problems when you come into Level 2, but there's also information out there such as fact pages, error messages, how to look at third-party problems, how to prepare for a crash ahead of time. That's also where the performance guide is. Development stays on top of this link and updates it periodically with new problems that may be encountered or new information that needs to be published because it's something that may occur frequently. So, very good link to have. Would advise putting it in your favorites. Page 38, please. This gets to the end of our presentation. So to summarize what we've done, we've given you information to help you look at what the health of the system is, the health of your web server, and there's two more links we're providing here. The first link is your question and answers link off of the IHS DIAG. The second link is the IHS Developers Forum, DeveloperWorks Forum. Two good links to also maintain. Page 39, please. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about the upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts, like the one today, and to access previously recorded presentations such as the one Jim mentioned earlier. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information as well. You can visit the WebSphere user group org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up to learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Password Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. And now, back to you, David.
Thank you, Jim and Marvin, for a great presentation. And finally, don't forget to connect with us. You can be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with the subject of WSTE Subscribe, and you will receive a list of mailing lists that you may subscribe to. Also, if there is a topic you would like to see scheduled or if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You could also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program even better for you. We do welcome any ideas that you may have. At this time, Glenn, we would like to open the lines for questions.
1 moment, please, for your first question. Your first question comes from Kailash Kashida. Your line is open.
Yeah, Jim and Marvin, thank you for presenting this wonderful presentation. I have couple quick questions. One is regarding the plugin, and one is regarding the log rotation. The first question is there a way to intercept traffic that's going to the app server in the web at the web server level? Meaning, my question is, which one takes the precedence, the http.conf file or the plugin XML file? I don't know if I made it clear or not.
I'm not real sure what you're meaning by intercept the request. Could you elaborate
sure.
on that?
Yeah. For example, let's say that I have a JSP page on the app server, and let's assume that we have issues with that JSP page, and I want to redirect any request that's coming to that JSP page to some error page or something. So is that an option? Is that a possibility to do that at the web server?
The web server can do rewrite requests,
mm-hmm.
and within the rewrite request, that will get control before the plugin. So
okay.
you can utilize a rewrite to check for a specific URI or a specific pattern and then redirect that request and make sure you use the pass-through flag on the rewrite if you want the plugin to see it. If you don't want the plugin to see the results of that rewrite, then you don't use the pass-through. But in this particular case, it sounds like you would be doing maybe a proxy type, or you would change the URI to something the plugin can't see that then goes to somewhere else. There are a number of tricks you can do with rewrite, but the rewrite would do what you want, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, that was my basic question. Does the rewrite rule take precedence or the plugin?
Yeah, the rewrite gets control first. You have to remember to use the pass-through flag if you want the plugin to see the results of the rewrite.
When you say the results of the rewrite pass-through, what do you mean by that?
In other words, if you change the URI to a different value,
mm-hmm.
if you want the plugin to see the actual change of the rewrite, you have to use the pass-through flag.
Okay. But the rewrite does take precedence over the plugin.
Correct.
Okay. And the next one is regarding the log rotation. You mentioned that we can rotate access logs and error logs. Is there a way to rotate plugin logs as well?
There's no official supported way. There's been techniques we've seen users utilize to do tricks such as trying to close the plugin and reopen it, but the plugin itself does not support rotate logs.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Certainly.
Your next question comes from Brian Lee. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hi, Brian.
My question is, in our production, the personal certificate of the plugin will be expired soon. As you mentioned, even the personal certificate of plugin is not used. If the personal certificate is going to expire, then what the consequence is?
Okay, you're saying your certificate, if it expires, what are the consequences?
Yes, what are the consequences?
It depends on the operating system, but I know in particular cases that it can keep the plugin from coming up, in which case you won't be serving requests to the application server, because that's checked at the actual start of the plugin, so it can keep the plugin from loading.
So
we've had multiple cases where that comes in as application server can't server request. Now, if the only time the plugin really needs that certificate is if you're doing client authentication, yes, within the application server, which gives you the equivalent of mutual authentication. Otherwise,
no, we
just delete that certificate.
We don't use the mutual certificate. We only the plugin authenticate the application server. So, because I had a consultation with the IBM WebSphere technical support, PMR support, and she said the personal certificate of the plugin is not used. Even if the certificate expired, it doesn't matter. We don't have to do anything. Is that correct?
I've seen the cases where the plugin certificate expiring will actually cause issues. I think it's operating system dependent. But I would say
update
the plugin certificate or either get rid of it.
We had a security flash for that.
So the operating system we are using is the AIX 6.1.
I would have to go back and look. I don't know off the top of my head which particular operating systems might actually let you get by with it. I know I've seen multiple PMRs come in where the plugin certificate expiring is not a good thing. I don't recall whether it totally disables the SSL transport or whether it keeps the plugin from coming up. There are certain cases where we will actually go forward and just disable the transport, such as a bad certificate, the KDB certificate not... I think the KDB password expiring may actually kill things, whereas the plugin certificate is hit or miss as to whether it hurts you. To be safe, though, I would get rid of the certificate or create a brand new self-signed certificate.
But your suggestion is for the precaution, so we should change the personal certificate. Just renew the certificate, then copy the KBD file into the plugin.
Right. The plugin certificate is a self-signed certificate. The only time I've ever seen it with an actual certificate authority certificate would be if you've got real high security in the account and everything is using certificate authorities that either they've issued themselves as their own authority or there's some type of high security in their account where they require everything being through a certificate authority such as VeriSign. And in some cases you have client authentication set to yes on the app server side, which causes the app server to request a certificate from the plugin. That's when the plugin certificate is really used, is if that client auth is set to yes. And that works the same as mutual authentication within the web server. You have the exchange of personal certificates between the two servers.
No, we don't use the mutual authentication, so we're just using the client authentication.
Yeah, my advice would be just to create a new self-signed certificate with a expiration date that doesn't expire.
Okay. Can you send the link to me about the personal certificate of the plugin? I will schedule the downtime for the renew the personal certificate of plugin. The plugin certificate we're not using certificate authorization. We're just using self-signed certificate.
You're asking for information to be sent to you on that?
Yes.
The best way to do that would be just to create a PMR and ask us to send that information to you.
Okay.
Your next question comes from Sachin Jain. Your line is open.
Sorry. Hey, hi. Thanks for the wonderful presentation. I have the same question which was asked earlier about the plugin rotation. And I know, you know, you guys already answered the question that it can be done by closing the plugin. But could you kind of elaborate on that? Because I have run into issues pertaining to rotation of the plugin logs. Like, you know, if I move the plugin file from the directory where it resides to some other directory and try to create a new plugin log file, plugin stops feeding data into the new log file. So how do I ensure that I am able to, you know, kind of rotate it as well as, you know, I'm not missing the log data?
Part of that goes into why the development team does not currently support rotating logs. There's no official way that we give support to or even recommend using. We're just aware that some people have created cron type scripts that do this type of thing. We don't have an actual supported technique that we endorse. So I would be willing to bet that you would lose potentially log entries depending on the level of logging you're doing and the timing of when scripts cause the file to be closed and reopened.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a known requirement with our development team to work on rotation for the plugin log, and that's something that they know that the user community would like to see.
Yeah, and I know part of the issue has to do with the fact that the plugin is running at the child level, so you've got multiple active processes and threads off of those processes. And each process is not really aware of what the other one's doing. So when you start getting into the logging and rotating of it, there's more issues that have to occur within the plugin side than you would from the IHS side, where you have the parent process available.
Yeah, I mean, that is what the problem I run into. I mean, if I try to rotate the new log file which I create, I don't get any data pertaining to the logging until I kind of, restart my web server, which would reload the plugins, and then, you know, I would get the new data. But, again, thanks for answering my question. It's good that IBM support is looking into it.
Yep.
Your next question comes from Gopal Daruni. Your line is open.
Hi. My question to the team is, in the midst of the day, this is from the HTTP plugin logs, I see that it has reached the maximum connection limit, and after that it further doesn't make any connections to the app servers. And the error exactly that I can read is failed to find a server in the group, cluster, blah, 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 all could be down or have reached the maximum connection limit. So my question is, why would we see this happening? Is it hitting some kind of a threshold from the HTTP server going to the app server? If at all, what is the tuning parameter that we need to increase that maximum connection limit from the plugin module to the app server?
That's probably a fairly standard error that we see, and oftentimes without having the detail of a plugin trace, you're having to make guesses. But quite often that's a result of the application on the app server side hanging or being unresponsive. The plugin makes a connection to the app server. And as long as we can make a connection, we don't know whether the app server is actually responding or not. So you could be sending requests across to, say, app server 2. That app server not being responsive, but it'll still take connections. So we'll send the request across and then wait for the server I/O timeout if it's set. If you're in a hung situation on the app server and you have a highly loaded web server, we could be sending hundreds of requests to the app server that's not responding and just eventually tying up connections to where there's no more left. That's one way you could actually see this. Of course, another scenario would be you're just in a situation where you're really getting close to the maximum threshold of all the resources available.
Right. What I look at is for the mod status. If that website server page can be displayed, it will show what's in read status.
Right.
What's waiting on the plugin to receive responses back from the app server. NPM stats in your error log. That'll give you a snapshot of what's happening. Typically, though, when you're reaching that, it's usually just the JVM's just not responding. And you can get some Java cores there. There's tech notes on ThermosGather, so you can actually see if there's a deadlock condition, perhaps, or database IOs that's just not being handled in the response criteria that you need.
Yeah. Perhaps that's not the situation. We bypass the HTTP server to find out if the web container, we hit directly the web container to see if the app server is responding, and it does. And there are no hung threads at that situation. I have noticed this new plugin just reports that it ran out of the maximum connections. But however, I can still bypass the HTTP server and hit the app server with no problems, and there are no hung threads at that point of time. That's what is bothering me. Maybe if some kind of an instrumentation that can be enabled at the plugin level to see, or also a parameter that where we can.
Well, there is a max connection, or there's a
and this has
max connections or max client it Max Connections?
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this has nothing to do with the HTTP Max clients at all.
No, I'm referring to the plugin CFG XML file.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would be interesting, yes.
That would be a field to check, because that comes into play based off of how many what they call pending connections are available to the app server, meaning existing connections that have gone across to the app server that are in use where we're waiting on a response. So if that number is too low, you might see a max connections hit.
So that should be in plugin CFG?
Plugin CFG.xml file, yeah.
Directive.
Your next question comes from Sandy Mokay. Your line is open.
Hi. My question is regarding the performance in HTTP, performance parameters in HTTP conf file. I know that you have given a link to us, but I just have a quick question on a parameter called timeout. Recently, one of our vendors told us to change their time from default 300 seconds to 21,600 seconds, which is really about 8 hours or something like that. And when I was kind of doing research on this parameter, it said that it will, for performance reason, you shouldn't have it that high or something like that. After changing that number, we didn't see much any issues or applications seem to be running fine, but then I wanted to know as to what is the best practice or where can I find additional information. I couldn't see much information on Apache or IBM site for that particular parameter.
I'm not sure why they would tell you to have the timeout that high.
Yeah, I hear you. Yes.
And basically that's timeout is affecting... You've already received the request, or you're waiting on information from the client, and it hadn't sent it, if I recall correctly.
It says the number of seconds before receives and sends the timeout. I'm not sure. That's why I wanted to know. You know, I really tried to search the, like, you know, Google on this parameter. There wasn't much information available.
Well, so come into play if you were doing something like a post request where data is supposed to be sent.
Uh-huh.
And we're still waiting. We've issued a read for the data, and we're waiting on that data. That's where that timeout parameter would hit. So having a value of 8 hours just seems way too large. 5 minutes is usually more than necessary for a timeout when... You've actually issued a read to the client, and you're waiting on a response. This isn't like a keep alive where you're actually completed the request. This we're waiting on data from something.
Right. So does that the fallout from I was thinking a kind of a backlash or fallout from that setting. From overall application perspective, I didn't see it seemed to be running okay, but it, in my mind, I just wanted to go back and tell them, hey, this is not something that we should keep it for a long time. We need to find out why it is 8 hours or something like that.
That so, almost makes me think they're not setting the parameter they think they are.
Okay. Okay, so your that link that you have provided, will that kind of touch base on this? Would that explain more?
I think it would probably get into what you're looking for, because timeout's not something we see very often, because once IHS gets the request, it's done with it. And we're not often in cases where... We're waiting on data unless you're in something like a post request where the client never sends the data. And that's where you want a five-minute timeout or even smaller, because you don't want to be sitting there waiting for 8 hours on a client to send something and tying up a connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Okay, thank you. I guess I will take this kind of and probably run with it and see what can be done. Maybe reset this parameter and back to square one and take it from there, I guess.
Yeah, I've seen where you do things on something like our load balancer, where you set up stale timeout values for something like 8 hours because you're dealing with LDAP, and they tend to keep those connections open forever. So you want a very large timeout on something like that. But that's usually more for something like the load balancer, where you want to keep a connection open to your back-end client because
mm-hmm.
you're going to an LDAP server.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Thank you.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Thank you, Glenn. There are a few questions that have come in to the group chat, and we can address those. The first one is, can you tell us some typical settings for high performance, such as thread settings, threads per child, etc.?
There's no one set answer to that. Unfortunately, I wish there was, because then we could use it every time that question comes in. But it's going to depend upon each client's setting, what kind of applications are on the back end, how many users are coming in, the CPU size. In some CPUs, you may hit a threshold at 2,000 users. On another box, you may have 40 gig of RAM available and can handle 5,000 clients. It also depends on whether the web server is doing things like CGI scripts or just passing straight through to the plugin. So there's no one set answer, and that's why we typically don't get into tuning in the support side and would more than likely refer you to IBM services or someone.
Okay, thank you. The next question that I saw in the chat, I have seen that IHS uses CMS database for certificate management. Is there a roadmap for supporting JKS key stores?
CMS, or the KDB, is what IHS and the plugin use. So that's typically what we're aware of. The JKS is something the application server supports, and they provide an interface on the application server console under, certificate management, I believe. So that's the, and I don't know that there's a roadmap per se. That's handled by a different group, but the application server certificate management is what we would reference for the JKS files. You can certainly open them and look at them with iKeyman, but the app server provides interfaces for that on their own certificate management.
Okay, thanks. The next question. In a configuration where IHS and WAS servers are co-located on the same server, have you seen situations where SSL is turned off between the plugin and WAS for performance reasons? One way to do that is configuring the inbound transport channel, but is that the best way to accomplish that?
From the plugin point of view, if you eliminate the HTTPS transport, the plugin's going to do the equivalent of SSL offloading and use the HTTP transport. So it's obviously going to improve your performance if you don't have encryption involved in the SSL handshake. I don't know what the exact numbers in terms of performance gain is going to be. There again, that's going to depend upon each application server, how many SSL transports are involved. But if you can do away with the SSL from the web server / plugin to the app server, it's definitely worth doing for performance reasons.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
The next question. I thought the plugin was responsible for workload management rather than generic load balancing, and that goes back to the slide where you were talking about load balancing.
The plugin is not a high-end load balancer such as, say, the Edge load balancer. It's got basic algorithms, and it's going to do some weight checking and load balancing, but it's not going to be a complex load balancer like your Edge would be or, say, the ODR. When you get into products that are designed for load balancing, such as the Edge load balancer, you've got complex algorithms for figuring out how many active connections there are, what the CPU load might be, what memory usage might be. The plugin has none of that type interface, so it's going to do more basic load balancing and primarily look at your session ID to determine affinity.
Okay, thanks. A couple more questions. Does plug-in workload management interface with the WLM? We ran web servers on the mainframe.
I suspect what they're talking about is the workload management and having some type of advisor. The plug-in doesn't have any type advisor in terms of determining what servers are loaded, what servers are not loaded, in terms of being able to get some type of advisor information for determining which server to select. I know the Edge load balancer has a WLM advisor, which sounds sort of like what you're talking about. And my basic answer to that would be is the plugin has no advisor capability, so it's not going to be able to take that type of information into figuring out which server to select.
Okay, thanks. And I've got two more. The next one, I'm not sure what they're really asking, but I'll read it to you. Security exit support under IHS Apache GWAPI. I'm not sure what that's really getting at.
SSL for security.
If they're talking about an Apache exit under normal Apache, their whole approach to SSL is different. They're using open source SSL, whereas IHS is using our own routine. So I would say I'm not aware of any exit such as that.
Okay, thanks. And then I've got one more. Is there a utility that can read headers? What's put in them and what's taken out? This is for a reverse proxy.
A lot of that depends on what they mean by what kind of utility they're looking for. There are utilities such as HTTP Watch, Fiddler 2, you could even use Wireshark to look at from a client perspective. From the web server perspective, you could do something like enabling ModNet Trace, which will take dumps of the input. It's not actually going to look for specific headers, but you could use ModNet Trace to see what requests are coming in, what the headers contain. You can also log the header information in the access log. So you could utilize the access log as a way of logging specific headers you may be interested in. Part of it, you know, gets into what specifically they're trying to look at when they're talking reverse proxy. Some people call the plugin a reverse proxy. So it is a proxy to the app server. So it depends on more detail in terms of what they're trying to look at.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, you could remove headers or add headers with IHS as well by supplying, I think it's mod headers, and then adding or removing specific headers within IHS itself, but, you know, without knowing more detail about what they want.
Okay, thanks. And then another one just came into the chat session. I am new to WebSphere administration work. Do you have any recommendation how to start building up the knowledge on this subject?
There's actually I believe later this month, there is another Westy that talks about web server administration.
Yes.
Our colleague Bob Richter is doing that.
Yes, there is. It's actually, I assume you're talking about web server administration with the admin console?
That's it.
Yeah. That's actually Tuesday, October 30th.
Okay. And I think we have another one October 11th about the WCT, the PCT, which is the plugin configuration tool.
Yeah, plugin configuration tool version 8.0 on October 11th.
Yeah,
right.
That's version 8 specific.
And I would encourage this person to send an email, as we mentioned, to WSE Help with the WSTE subscribe in the subject line. That was on a previous slide, and then you can be notified of these upcoming events.
And just to put a plug in for Bob on the administration one, he was level 3 in development in the admin console for IHS, so that should be an excellent presentation.
Okay. I believe that's all the questions in the group chat. Well, at this time, I believe we'll conclude the presentation. We certainly hope the information presented today has been valuable. We appreciate your participation and hope you will join us for future web presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. I want to thank everyone for joining us today, and thank you, Marvin and Jen, for a great presentation.
Thank you.
Thanks.